In Hilbesheimer's Footsteps by Pier Vittorio Orelli. And this is an afterword to the publishing in the book of by G. Sapp of Metropolis Architecture by Hilbesheimer. Ludwig Hilbesheimer's oeuvre, both his projects and his writings, has had a strange critical fortune. At first glance, it might seem that his work has been overlooked, almost forgotten in the literature on modern architecture. This is true if we consider that his contribution is almost absent from all the major histories of modern architecture in the 20th century. Moreover, Hilbesheimer's work is known, if it is known at all, only through the two famous perspectives of his proposal for a high-rise city, 1924. These two images have been used so often to represent the horror of the modern metropolis that they have become clichés, especially because they are often considered only as images and not as illustrations of a precise urban proposal. And yet Hilbesheimer's oeuvre has inspired the work and the approach of architects and scholars as radically diverse as Manfredo Tafuri, Aki Zoom, Giorgio Grassi, Rem Koolhaas, K. Michael Hayes, Albert Pope, and Charles Wandheim, to name just a few. If Hilbesheimer has suffered mainstream neglect, he has surely become an architect's architect, a cult figure whose rigorous theoretical projects paradoxically seem to age much less than the work of many of his contemporaries. This is due to his radical and uncompromising approach to architecture and the city. This approach was sustained not through manifestos or utopian proposals for a different world. On the contrary, Hilbesheimer's radicality consists of his lucid and realist analysis of the capitalist city. This realism also informs his design proposals, which, although executed as theoretical proposals, expressed social, political, and formal implications that responded to the reality of the capitalist city. His work was radical because it lacked all idealism about the reality of the capitalist city, and even if his proposals were drastic attempts to reform the city within a social democratic framework, he did not discount the social and geographical consequences of the new forms of production brought about by capitalist development. This is particularly evident in the peculiar style of his drawings. The urban atmosphere evoked by his drawings for the high-rise city is neither futuristic, nor dramatic, nor dystopian. Hilbesheimer's images, especially in his early work, describe an urban atmosphere that is detached, harsh, precise, and subtly disquieting. Perhaps the best expression of the attitude conveyed by the illustrations of Hilbesheimer's projects is found in the opening lines of Thomas Mann's Royal Highness, which Aki Zoom used to introduce its theoretical project No Stop City of 69 to 71, a project that, as we shall see, was inspired by Hilbesheimer's drawings for the high-rise city. Quote, "The time is noon on an ordinary weekday. The season of the year does not matter. The weather is fair to moderate. It is not raining, but the sky is not clear. It is a uniform light grey, uninteresting and sombre, and the street lies in a dull and sober light which robs it of all mystery, all individuality." The sobriety of Hilbesheimer's images corresponds to the realism of his analysis of the capitalist city. But despite the clarity of his theories and proposals, his writings and projects have been interpreted in very different, sometimes opposing ways. Indeed, Hilbesheimer's work has inspired radically different approaches to the contemporary city. In the notes that follow, I will outline some of these approaches, in particular those of Aldo Rossi, Giorgio Grassi, Manfredo Tafuri, Aki Zoom, K. Michael Hayes, and Rem Koolhaas. In 1967, the publishing house Marsilio, founded by Paolo Ciarelli, and Antonio Negri, among others, initiated a book series on architecture and urbanism that was edited by Aldo Rossi called Polis. And there's a footnote that says, for a very insightful history of the Polis book series and other editorial projects related to architecture in Italy between the 50s and 60s, see Fiorella Vanini. The book's called La Libreria dell'Architetto of 2011. The previous year, Marsilio had published Rossi's famous book, L'Architettura della Città, The Architecture of the City, which had a tremendous impact on architectural and urban discourse in Italy. The success of the book was an incentive for Rossi and the editors at Marsilio to publish a series of texts related to architecture and the city. Rossi's ambition for Polis was to publish not only new texts but also old and forgotten texts, especially texts related to the rise of what Rossi defined as, quote, rationalist architecture. Among the first titles Rossi published was Ludwig Hilbersheimer's Entfaltung einer Planungsidee, Development of a Planning Concept of 1963, which was translated by Rossi's wife, the stage actress Sonia Gessner, and introduced by Rossi's protege and early collaborator Giorgio Grassi. It is important to note the similarity between the title of Rossi's book, L'Architettura della Città, and the title of Hilbersheimer's most important book, Großstadtarchitektur, Metropolis Architecture, which is translated into Italian as L'Architettura della Grande Città. As has been recently demonstrated, there is no doubt that Rossi was inspired by Hilbersheimer's book, and although references to the German architect and theorist are rather scarce in Rossi's text, his early collaborators confirm his strong interest in Hilbersheimer's work and especially in Großstadt architecture. It is clear that the affinity Rossi felt for Hilbersheimer lay in the idea of rooting architectural form within the reality of the city. Following the example of Hilbersheimer's Großstadt architecture, Rossi sought to elucidate the laws that govern the form of the city as a prerequisite for understanding architecture itself. For both Hilbersheimer and Rossi, the city comes first. It is the only meaningful context, both physical and conceptual, in which architecture can be understood at a fundamental level. And yet for both Hilbersheimer and Rossi, it is precisely through architecture as a physical artifact that the city is knowable. This understanding of the relationship between architecture and the city is evident in the organization of Hilbersheimer's book. Hilbersheimer first puts forward a general understanding of the city as a comprehensive system of relationships, as a plan. Only then does he describe the city through exemplary structures. Organizing the book in this way, Hilbersheimer stresses the dependence of architecture on the political and geographical organization of the city. And yet for Hilbersheimer, this broader understanding of the city finds its ultimate confirmation in the interior organization of buildings. Hilbersheimer never uses the term typology, but it is clear that for him the overall organization of the city is dependent on the organization of the single unit, the cell. These observations can clearly be read in Rossi's intentional use of specific language, particularly in the Milanese architect's reintroduction of the notion of typology as the fundamental framework for the study of the morphology of the city. The similarity between Hilbersheimer's and Rossi's method is striking. For both architects, the form of the city is generated from the distributive logic urban types. And both understood types as manifestations of the ethos of a society in pure architectural terms. Why then did Rossi decide to publish Entfaltung einer Planungsidee instead of the more canonical Großstadtarchitektur? The answer may be the Enthüllung einer Planungsseide was a more recent title from Hilbersheimer's prolific bibliography. But another reason may be that Rossi felt that Großstadt architecture was too closely related to a particular moment of the modern metropolis, while Entfaltung einer Planungsseide offered a retrospective analysis of Hilbersheimer's career as a planner. Since the Italian translation was published only a few months before Hilbersheimer's death, we might presume that Hilbersheimer himself did not want to republish his old book and preferred his latest work, since it would be a more up-to-date version of his theory of the city. We can be sure that Rossi liked the slightly autobiographical tone of Entfaltung einer Planungsseide, in which Hilbersheimer presented his theory and projects as if they unfolded according to a lifelong existential project. If Rossi's reference to Hilbersheimer was indirect, Giorgio Grassi's relationship to Hilbersheimer's writings and projects is clear. One could say that it was Grassi who rediscovered Hilbersheimer in the 1960s. Apart from his introduction to the Italian edition of Entfaltung einer Planungsseide, Hilbersheimer was a central reference in Grassi's book, The Logical Construction of Architecture, which was published the same year as the Italian translation of Entfaltung einer Planungsseide, which is 1967. In this book, Grassi focused on the possibility of producing architecture according to rigorous and self-evident principles. In order to find such an architecture, Grassi focused in particular on two moments of modern Western architecture: the French Grand Seal, represented by such figures as Pierre Lemuet, Roland Frérat de Chambray, and Charles-Étienne Brissot, architects and authors of influential treatises and manuals of architecture, and on German architecture of the years of the Weimar Republic, represented by the work of Bruno Taut, Alexander Klein, and Hilbersheimer. For Grassi, these two moments in the history of architecture, which he identified as classicism and rationalism respectively, advanced an idea of architecture indissolubly linked to an idea of the city. In these two periods, Grassi argued, the project of the city and the project of architecture coincided within the same propositions. These propositions were put forward in a logical way, according to the most basic convention shared by architects of the time. Think of Lemuet's Architecture de Accompagnement, in which architecture, freed from the representational role of the classical orders, is reduced to its basic image, the urban dwelling. This approach resulted in an architecture that for Grassi was both autonomous, because it was intelligible in itself as legible form, but also profoundly rooted within the city for which it was designed. Grassi's interest in Hilbersheimer was motivated by the need Hilbersheimer shared with Rossi to search for an approach to architecture liberated from the confines of authorship and style. In his introduction to Entfaltung einer Planungsseide, Grassi emphasized that even though Hilbersheimer's theoretical projects, including the high-rise city, have precise architectural images, they are nevertheless characterized by the absence of style. For Grassi, the forms produced by Hilbersheimer were not just types but archetypes: the slab, the block, the high-rise building, the row house. Hilbersheimer's method of design was not to seek the invention of original forms, but to assemble unprecedented combinations and to use them as the basis for the production of new types. In the high-rise city, for example, Hilbersheimer superimposed two urban types that were at that time seen as radically antithetical: the block and the slab. In Hilbersheimer's designs, an extreme simplicity of form corresponds to a highly original combination of different archetypes, the end result of which is an unprecedented organization of the city and its functions. Hilbersheimer's influence is also evident in Grassi's design work. Grassi not only adopted Hilbersheimer's terse and precise approach to architectural rendering, he also quoted projects like the high-rise city in his competition entry for the regional administrative offices in Trieste of 1974. And in a lecture delivered in 1978, Grassi insisted on the validity of Hilbersheimer's formulation of the relationship between architecture and the city, against the affirmation of postmodern historicism, which would eventually affect the work of Rossi. Grassi still looked to Hilbersheimer as a point of reference for a civic anonymous architecture completely divorced from concerns for form or expression. If Grassi and Rossi, early in his career, looked to Hilbersheimer as the most important proponent of a rational approach to architecture, Manfredo Tafuri and Andrea Branzi understood the German architect in a slightly different way, emphasizing both the political and the iconoclastic dimensions of his work. In 1969, Tafuri published his seminal essay Per una critica dell'ideologia architettonica, Toward a Critique of Architectural Ideology, in the Marxist journal Contropiano, in which he launched an attack on the utopian and reformist aspirations of modern architecture. Tafuri's position was heavily influenced by the theories of the operists, a group of radical Marxist militants and scholars gathered around the theories of Mario Tronti. They were very critical, if not entirely against, the reformist agenda of the left, which they saw as a strategic lever for capitalist power over the working class. Tafuri's fundamental argument in his essay was that modern architecture, especially the avant-garde movements, had the ideological role of prefiguring models of organization for the city within the incessant development of capitalism. For Tafuri, the allegedly utopian dimension of architecture had the specific role of making emerging cycles of urban restructuring culturally and socially acceptable. For example, Tafuri described the trend of picturesque landscaping as promoting the ideology of an allegedly, quote, natural city in the face of massive industrial exploitation and land value speculation. Avant-garde movements such as Cubism, Futurism, Dada, and Gestalt gave this industrial reality its proper aesthetic image, characterized by shock and productive alienation. Once the next cycle of capitalist development was accomplished, these avant-garde projects were left behind as, quote, form without utopia, as useless weapons for both capital and its antagonist, the working class. Tafuri thought the only way to overcome this reality of architecture was to go beyond architecture as the design of objects and to dive into the economic processes that produced architecture itself. For Tafuri, the only architect who had adopted this approach was Hilbersheimer. Tafuri described Hilbersheimer's observation that the architecture of the city is dependent on the solution of two issues, the design of the elementary cell and the entire urban whole, as the most lucid analysis of the capitalist metropolis. If Rossi and Grassi had interpreted this observation as the foundation of the relationship between typology and morphology, for Tafuri this observation meant something entirely different. It meant that Hilbersheimer had understood the city as a true unity, but not as a metaphysical or transcendental unity, nor as a harmonious architectural unity. The unity of the capitalist city lay, rather, in its identity as an enormous, quote, social machine, an apparatus in which the type, not the overall image of the city, represents the starting point for urban design. For Tafuri, Hilbert-Sima had understood that reduced in these terms, the city was no longer a composition of buildings, but rather an organization of the economic process. The unity of the city is thus no longer the city as object, as tangible artifact, but the city as economic cycle that processes infinitely reproducible types. As Tafuri wrote, quote, "In the face of modernized production techniques and the expansion and rationalization of the market, the architect, as producer of objects, became an incongruous figure. It was no longer a question of giving form to single elements of the urban fabric, nor even to simple prototypes. Once the true unity of the production cycle has been identified in the city, the only task the architect can have is to organize the cycle." Taking this proposition to its extreme conclusion, Hilbert-Sima insists on the role of elaborating, quote, organizational models as the only one that can fully reflect the need for tailorizing building production as the new task of the technician who is now completely integrated into this process. On the basis of this position, Hilbert-Sima was able to avoid involvement in the, quote, crisis of the object, so anxiously articulated by such architects as Loos and Tout. For Hilbert-Sima, the object was not in crisis because it had already disappeared from his spectrum of considerations. The only emerging imperative was that dictated by the laws of organization, and therein lies what has been correctly seen as Hilbert-Sima's greatest contribution. So that's a quote from Tafuri's Toward a Critique of Architectural Ideology. Tafuri's reading of Hilbert-Sima as a lucid interpreter of the capitalist city had a profound influence on the Florentine collective Archizum, especially on the development of Archizum's most important project, No Stop City, of 1969 to 71. The project was executed for an exhibition of the work by Archizum in Rotterdam that never took place, and it was intended as an illustration per absurdum of the effects of the capitalist city. The basic principle of No Stop City consisted in imagining the city as a superimposition of three spaces, the factory, the supermarket, and the parking lot. No Stop City was not conceived as an alternative to the existing city, but as an exacerbation of its elements, producing what the operaists had called the Sitta Fabrica, the city as a fabrica, as a factory, an urban condition in which the organization of production was extended beyond the perimeter of the factory to all forms of social life. According to Tronti, with the advent of the welfare state, in which production was organically linked with consumption, the evolution of production had reached a stage in which the factory and society coincided in the same plan of capital. And yet for the operaists, it was precisely at this point that capital would be forced to reveal its ties to the labour force of the working class. With No Stop City, Archizum sought to reveal this condition in its most brutal form, a continuous space devoid of any architectural quality and made inhabitable by the even distribution of the most basic equipment, a bathroom placed every 50 metres, for example. As Brunzi has stated, the publication of Hilbert-Sima's projects in the Italian edition of Enthauptung einer Planungsidee was a fundamental trigger for the project. It is important to note here the ambiguous relationship between Rossi and Grassi on the one hand and Archizum and Superstudio on the other. There is no doubt that the radical rationalism of Rossi's and Grassi's early architecture had a strong impact on the minimalist turn of both collectives around 1968. Brunzi observed Rossi's interest in, quote, extreme architects such as Etienne-Louis Boulay and Hilbert-Sima, was a fundamental influence that pushed the members of Arkizim to purge their initial interest in pop imagery. And yet, Tafiri's more politically oriented and disenchanted reading of Hilbesheimer, which took no account of neo-rationalist imagery, was more influential on the development of No Stop City. Tafiri's Hilbesheimer revealed, regardless of the German architect's intentions, the radical dissolution of the city as form within the totalizing space of urbanization. Against the colorful images of Archigram, the rediscovery of Hilbesheimer revealed the generic ethos of the modern city, as Branzi has recently recalled. And this is a quote from Branzi. The idea of an inexpressive, catatonic architecture, the outcome of the expansive forms of the logic of the system and its class antagonists, was the only modern architecture of interest to us, a liberating architecture corresponding to mass democracy, devoid of demos and kratos, of people and of power, and both centerless and imageless. A society freed from the rhetorical forms of humanitarian socialism and rhetorical progressivism. Architecture that gazed fearlessly at the logic of grey, unaesthetic and de-dramatized industrialism. The colourful visions of pop architecture were replaced by Ludwig Hilbesheimer's pitiless urban images, those of a city without qualities, designed for people without preordained qualities. Free, therefore, to express in an autonomous way its own creative, political, and behavioral energies. The greatest possible freedom occurred where integration was strongest. Alienation was a new artistic condition. Hilbesheimer's projects were thus understood as an invitation to confront the most radical effects of the capitalist city. What is more, the high-rise city was an invitation to go beyond the formal fetishism through which other avant-garde groups, such as the Japanese metabolists, had confronted the social and technological transformations of the urban environment. Moreover, in the high-rise city, Hilbesheimer had demonstrated that in an advanced capitalist society, life and work coincide within the same urban system. He thereby suggested that the desire to zone the city into different sectors, a desire Le Corbusier clung to, was unnecessary. Even if Hilbesheimer's projects were conceived as solutions to specific problems, his peculiar graphic presentations, in which patterns replace building forms, inspired Arkizim in its attempt to define a, quote, non-figurative architecture for the city. Such non-figurative architecture was meant to reveal the city's brute objectivity against the humanist aspirations of modernism. K. Michael Hayes has also sought to counter the humanist interpretation of modern architecture. In Modernism and the Post-Humanist Subject, published in 1992, Hayes interprets Hilbesheimer's work as part of a reformulation of the subject-object relationship in architecture. Hayes observes that in modern historiography, the interpretation of modern architecture has taken the form of two canonical narratives. On the one hand, modern architecture is presented under the rubric of function, in which the objectivity of technological development is seen as overwhelming the human dimension of architectural form. On the other hand, critics and historians who have opposed this view of modern architecture have advocated for a humanist interpretation in which a sovereign individual human subject regains full control of his own space. Against both interpretations, Hayes proposes that a fundamental category of modern architecture is the specific subjectivity formed by an intense dialectic between subject and object. For Hayes, the process of rationalization implied by the process of modernization called the definition of the subject as a, quote, self-creating conscience and will, that is to say, of humanism, into question. Confronted with this reality, in this book, Hayes seeks to read the legacy of modern architecture in the terms that other disciplines have used to interpret modernity, as an act of negation of the most fundamental assumptions of humanism. Like the atonal music of Schoenberg or the non-narrative films of Hans Richter and Viking Egeling, which Hilbersheimer admired greatly, in the most extreme versions of modern architecture, such as those advanced by Hannes Meyer and Hilbersheimer, architectural form is reconceived according to an aesthetic of renunciation, uncertainty, and incompleteness. For Hayes, these aesthetic terms are fully developed in Hilbersheimer's projects and style of representation. Hayes notes how in such a project as Hilbersheimer's Vorschlag zur Citybebauung, Proposal for a City Centre Development of 1930, axonometric drawing suppresses any sense of depth in the reading of urban space. Urban form is reduced to a pattern in which any idea of origin or composition is suppressed in favour of a serial order. And yet for Hayes, such explicit manifestation of the abstract ethos of the metropolis is not simply the accomplishment of the, quote, real functioning of its architecture. On the contrary, for Hayes, it is precisely Hilbersheimer's peculiar way of rendering the metropolis that deconstructs any relationship of cause and effect between form and function. In Hilbersheimer's drawings, the metropolis appears as an overdetermined process in which the two fundamental tenets of the humanist project, causality and origin, are effaced, yielding an anonymous and non-representational architectural language. In Hayes's reading, Hilbersheimer's approach to the architecture of the metropolis is neither formalist nor functionalist. Hilbersheimer's and Meyer's architecture makes visible, quote, that things are just what they are, utterly shorn of any metaphysical illusion of artistic authenticity, unity, or depth. Similarly, in the work of Rem Koolhaas, particularly in his urban projects and theories of the 1980s, we find an appropriation of Hilbersheimer's work in support of an anti-formalist but also anti-deterministic position. While Hayes was writing his book, which originated in his PhD dissertation at MIT, Koolhaas had already started a modernist campaign in favour of the metropolis, against the historicist architecture that became very popular in Europe in the 1980s. If for Tafuri and Archizum, Hilbersheimer's architecture of the metropolis represented the end of architecture, its final dissolution in the sea of urbanization, for Koolhaas, the forces of the metropolis were precisely the last chance for architecture to reclaim its urban role. This position was enthusiastically declared in the very name of Koolhaas and Elia Dengalis's practice, which in this sense was a clear statement of purpose, Office for Metropolitan Architecture, OMA. As recounted by Dengalis, Hilbersheimer's harsh architectural imagery was also present in OMA's early work as a deliberate complement to the hedonism and irony of the practice's metropolitan projects. This is evident in OMA's 1976 proposal for a housing complex with urban facilities on Welfare Island in New York City. In this project, OMA revisited a classic urban theme, also appropriated by Hilbersheimer, the boarding house, in which the typology of the hotel is developed as strategy for housing. For Koolhaas and Dengalis, as for Hilbersheimer of the Großstadt architecture years, a truly metropolitan architecture had to be ruthlessly rooted within the most adverse conditions of the contemporary city. But while Hilbersheimer sought to tame and reform these conditions, OMA accepted and accommodated them within a new urban architecture. OMA's search for a new metropolitan architecture was a radical refusal of both the historicist nostalgia that in the early 1980s affected many European architects and of the return to modernism in its critical and regionalist versions, as was seen in Spanish and Portuguese architecture. It is precisely within this attempt that Coolhouse wrote two of his most important programmatic texts. Quote, Our New Sobriety, published on the occasion of OMA's provocative contribution to Paolo Portoghese's Venice Biennale in 1980, and secondly, Imagining Nothingness, a short text that declared that the absence of architecture can be seen precisely as the greatest potential for its resurrection. Both texts clearly resonate with Hilbersheimer's metropolitan approach to architecture. For Coolhouse, as for the German architect, the complexity of the contemporary city requires a radical sobriety of form. This is evident in such seminal projects as the competition entry for the redevelopment of Melun Senat near Paris of 87, and the project for the Morgan Bank headquarters in Amsterdam of 1985. In which architectural intervention is reduced to a minimum in order to fully accommodate programs that can hardly be predicted or contained. In the text Imagining Nothingness, Hilbersheimer's quote, zero-degree urbanism is cited, among references to Pompeii and the Berlin Wall, as an example of urbanism in which space as, quote, empty space is more important than form. As already intuited by ArchiZoom and theorized by another admirer of Hilbersheimer, the American scholar and theorist Albert Pope, the post-industrial city is no longer defined by form, it is defined by space. And there's a footnote to see Albert Pope's Ladders of 1996. And yet this empty space is far from empty. According to Coolhouse and Pope, the empty space of the post-Fordist metropolis is congested by all kinds of volatile programs and activities whose sociological life reaches far beyond the traditional forms of the city. Attracted by extreme urban conditions, Coolhouse had already in the early 1970s considered starting a research institute in collaboration with Adolfo Natalini from Superstudio, completely devoted to the study of the contemporary city. The idea would be partially realized in the early 1990s in the Großstadt Foundation, and it would finally take the form of the Harvard Project on the City, a research project initiated in 1996, completely freed from the necessity of designing new or alternative cities. Yet while for Hilbersheimer the chaotic situation of the city was caused by capitalist exploitation, the word capital seems to almost disappear in Coolhouse's analysis of the city. If Coolhouse has moved urban research far beyond the scope of architectural concerns, he certainly had not considered what, for Hilbersheimer of Großstadt architecture, was the cause of urban chaos. Capitalist accumulation. While Hilbersheimer, following a social democratic agenda, believed that the new forms of production brought about by capitalist development could be tamed and reformed for a more rational organization of the city, Coolhouse has not put forward any program for the general reform of the contemporary city. If Hilbersheimer proposed design solutions, Coolhouse prefers, in his own words, to quote, surf the waves of the metropolis, end quote. In these notes, I have focused on the legacy of the European work of Hilbersheimer because of its immediate connection to Großstadt architecture. However, it is important to mention that Hilbersheimer's American period has also inspired original interpretations of the contemporary city. In recent years, the projects and investigations that Hilbersheimer began developing in the 1940s have been revisited by Albert Pope and the theorist of landscape urbanism, Charles Waldheim. though in very different ways, both Pope and Waldheim have found in Hilversheimer's urban projects precursors to an idea of the city that is strongly related to the political and social ethos of the post-war American city. For Waldheim, the texts he's referring to in a footnote are Charles Waldheim's, and the article is called Notes Toward a History of Agrarian Urbanism from 2010, and also published, it seems, in The Observer. For Waldheim, Hilversheimer's approach to city planning offers a way to structure territory that does not require a differentiation between the city and urbanization. Specifically, Waldheim sees the materialization of a project like Lafayette Park, executed in collaboration with Mies, as the culmination of a lifelong investigation of settlement principles that gives us a far more nuanced view of Hilversheimer as the planner of a potential American city. Pope has offered a provocative reading of Hilversheimer's dissolution of the grid, as evident in Hilversheimer's project for Marquette Park, as an anticipation of the crisis of the American grid caused by the pressures of the splintering forces of the post-Fordist era. Perhaps Pope's attitude towards this crisis exemplifies Hilversheimer's attitude toward the city. Accept the present condition and reform it from within. There is no doubt that in the last 20 years, architecture has moved in a direction antithetical to what might be called an approach a la Hilversheimer. While Hilversheimer advocated on architecture, governed by a general law in order to better confront the complexity of the city, today the reality of architectural production could not be further from such a program. While the contradictions and asymmetries of the capitalist city have only intensified, the majority of architects have indulged in a narrowing of their concerns that restricts design to the scale of the architectural object and leaves the city unconsidered. Commercial pressure on offices leaves little space for architects to undertake abstract or theoretical investigations. Practicing architects tend to adjust their rather fragmentary findings into what is today called, quote, research, which very often ends up as nothing more than an unsystematic and compromised collection of flashy images and inconclusive diagrams. Another emerging trend in our time of economic recession is the architect as activist, as a figure who moves beyond a concern for form and directly engages with social problems through much more volatile means: workshops, exhibitions, biennales, events, advocacy. In this case, the immediacy of action risks obfuscating the overall picture of the urban situation, reducing the latter to a, quote, innocent, end quote, playground, and thus masking structural problems. On the other hand, academic research on the city often succumbs to either unnecessary complexity or imprecision in defining a vision. But the most problematic aspect of research on the contemporary city is the total disconnection between, on the one hand, an understanding of architecture in relation to urban form, and on the other, an understanding of architecture in relationship to political economy. Those who focus on political economy tend to view the role of architectural form as irrelevant in the development of the city. Those who focus on architecture or urban design seem completely uninterested in engaging the political and economic forces that produce the city. Perhaps it is precisely in confronting this impasse, say, that a new reading of Hilversheimer's Großstadt architecture is timely. As we have seen, the crux of Hilversheimer's writings and theoretical projects was to root architectural form within a deep analysis of the contemporary city. Hilversheimer proposed neither easy formulas nor a final scenario. He put the problems on the table and identified existing architectural examples that might provide a basis for further research. Gianluca Policello, an Italian architect close to Rossi and the editor of the Italian edition of Grossstadt Architecture, published in 1998, observed that Hilbersheimer's organization of the book suggests a possible way to update its content. Hilbersheimer both begins and ends Grossstadt Architecture with general remarks, focusing the chapters in between on specific programs and building types contemporaneous with the publication itself. Policello suggested that if we were to take the introduction and conclusion as they are and change the rest of the book, we could produce a contemporary version of Grossstadt Architecture. This operation would reflect Hilbersheimer's critical attitude toward research. He never tried to crystallize his theories into definitive principles, and he himself would later criticize his early work. Of course, it is difficult to continue to compare the contemporary city to the metropolis of the euphoric and dramatic early decades of the 20th century. Yet I still believe that Hilbersheimer's attempt to link architectural form to the reality of the contemporary city remains a fundamental goal today. What is even more important is to consider the city no longer as a self-ruled reality, an unfathomable chaos or a bricolage of ad hoc actions, but as the end product of a conscious decision, that is, as a project.